Searching the Scriptures with Watchman Alexander, Episode 6.
Is everybody in the world going to die before someone finds the answer?
Do I have to remind you that theory is the beginning of the solution?
What are we up against? Is it a dangerous thing?
All I've ever known to be true is a lie.
I didn't say it would be easy. I just said it would be the truth.
I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
Welcome to Searching the Scriptures with Watchman Alexander, where we break away from religious systems and man-made dogma to learn the Word of God from an independent Hebraic perspective. And now your host, the prophecy buff who tackles the tough stuff, Alexander Lawrence.
Hello and shalom. The hour is late, the time is short, and the storm is coming. So this is your opportunity for a systems check. I'm here to wake up the sleeping servants of Yahweh God and equip them for the last days. I do that by teaching discernment, poring over prophecies, treating the infection of mystery Babylon in the church, and giving you courage. My book is Leviathan's Ruse, a comprehensive guide to the battle between good and evil. My website is WatchmanAlexander.com. All right, here we go with episode number 6. We're going to talk about prophecy, specifically modern prophecy, although we are going to talk about the ancient stuff as well to some degree. This show is going to start out as kind of a get-to-know-your-host time, but we're going to move on after that into discussion about the scriptures related to the gift of prophecy, and we're also going to talk about false prophets, what the danger is from them, what our response should be, and how you cannot be one. So first of all, what is a prophet, and how does that work? When we say the word prophecy, oftentimes we're thinking about a forecast of the future. We're thinking about some sort of information about things yet to come. But that's not all that prophecy is. Yes, a prophecy can be a prediction about the future, but it can also be just a word from the Lord. Prophets oftentimes wrote or spoke prophetic words that were not about the future. They were not oracles, but they were still prophetic. That's because prophecy is the human transmission of divine messages. It's the human transmission of divine messages. In other words, it's a human acting as a mouthpiece for the deity. This is not necessarily just our deity, Yahweh, the Most High God, but there are other deities, little g gods out there, who sometimes put prophecies into the mouths of the heathen prophets. So it's not exclusive to the Hebrew people, but the Hebrew God is the only one that says that he knows all things, both in the past and the future. He's completely omniscient, and therefore, anytime he speaks through a person, it's going to be 100% accurate. It's always going to be truth, because God never says anything that's not true. So if a person speaks something from the Lord, and it is not a true word that's not from the Lord, they're lying. Adonai's prophets are 100% accurate. Yahweh never misses a beat. So I want to tell you a little bit about the prophetic dreams and utterances that have happened in my family. Now, I do not call myself a prophet. I think sometimes I operate in that gifting. It may be one of the gifts of the Spirit that's been given to me. I don't really understand to the fullest extent how this works. You know, what qualifies someone to be in the office of prophet? Do they have to receive a "Thus saith the Lord" transmission in order to be qualified as prophet? Or can they have dreams and visions and that makes someone a prophet? I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that I have had prophetic visions, and I know that my mom has had prophetic dreams that saved people's lives, which I'm going to tell you about here in just a moment. So regardless of how we want to qualify this exactly, Yahweh will give his servants messages about the future so that the future can either be known and prepared for ahead of time, or can be changed. So sometimes prophecies are conditional. If it's conditional, that means we can take action based on the message of the prophecy. and by doing so, we will change the future in some way. An example of this would be Jonah going to Nineveh and declaring that they would be destroyed in a short time if they didn't repent. Well, that was the condition. If they repented, destruction would be delayed for however long they remained repentant and didn't to go back to their sinful ways. Now, eventually they did go back to their sinful ways and they got destroyed, but they were not destroyed within the original time frame because they did, in fact, repent as a whole. But some prophecies are not conditional. Some are going to come true regardless of what happens in the world, what happens with people, what kind of decisions we make. Nothing that we do is going to change it because all of that is already factored in to the prophecy. Now, I think sometimes prophecies will not have a condition and yet it can be delayed. Like God doesn't give a particular time frame for every prophecy. So if he says something will happen but doesn't say when, then it could be pushed off. But a delay does not necessarily mean a failed prophecy if there was no date setting involved in that prophecy. So my mom, as far as I know, has had three definite oracles. Three, I think each one of them was, I have to take that back. One of them was a dream combined with a really strong feeling during her waking hours. The other two were given to her in dreams. So let me start with the oldest one that I know of. My mom and I were going out of town. We were going to visit her parents. But my father, who was a peace officer, had to stay and work for the weekend. Well, my mom had a dream before we left that my father was going to be shot. And that was going to happen during the weekend when we were gone. And so she didn't want to go. And then he told her it was, you know, just a dream and he would be fine. And they went back and forth on this. And she said, no, this really is going to happen. And the only way I'm going to leave is if you promise to wear your vest, because he didn't always wear his bulletproof vest. In fact, he was good at forgetting it, I guess. So she made him swear to her that he would, in fact, wear his vest both days that he worked. So he agreed to this, and we went away for the weekend. Well, the next evening, he woke up for the night shift, and he was on his way to work. And it just so happened that there was a robbery of a 7-Eleven or some sort of convenience store like that that was near him while he was on his way in. So he was already talking to dispatch, and dispatch alerted him to the fact that he was the closest officer, even though he hadn't gotten to work yet. He was the closest officer to this incident. So he responded to it. And when he drove up to the 7-Eleven and parked his car right off to the side of it and jumped out of the car, he didn't realize that the robber was there still hiding in the bushes beside the building, right in front of where he parked his car. So when he got out, the robber stood up and shot at him, and the distance was, you know, not far at all. So it was a good shot, and it hit my dad right in the heart. Fortunately for my dad, he had gone back home. He had actually left without his vest, remembered that he had promised my mom, turned around, went back home, got his vest, and on his way back out the second time, that's when he responded to the call. So he had the bulletproof vest on. If he hadn't, that bullet would have gone right to his heart. He had, I believe, cracked or bruised ribs, but otherwise, he was fine. And that was when we really started paying attention to my mom's dreams. Well, sometime later, I was in second grade, and my mom had a dream about some terrible weather event happening with my school. Well, she was very reticent to send me off to school that day. She almost didn't do it. But she went ahead and sent me and thought, well, maybe this is, you know, just a dream and there's no real reason for me to keep him here. So I'll just keep an eye on things. Well, midway through the day, actually just after lunchtime, the weather got really bad. And there was a tornado that appeared in the vicinity of the school. This was not being reported anywhere. It's not like my mom had advanced knowledge of this. As far as I know, I haven't asked her about this recently, but from what I remember of her telling the story, she got a really bad feeling. Now, she was listening to the weather, but there wasn't anything that said that my school in particular was in danger. She just got a very, very bad feeling about it all of a sudden. And so she took off. She got in the truck and she headed for the school. When she got there, the tornado was just about to hit the school. I mean, she beat it by like a minute. All of us had been moved to the hallways. We were all in the sort of the interior of the school with our heads down and covered. I'd actually seen this thing starting to form because I was looking out the window during class on the side of the building that was facing where this tornado was coming from. And I saw all these leaves being picked up, starting to swirl, and the trees were just going crazy. So I kind of felt like something was happening right before the teachers started to come around and gather all the kids and move them out. And, you know, the principal came on the PA and all of that happened. It happened pretty quickly, you know, and it's kind of a blur. Of course, I was young, but I remember being very scared about it. And I remember feeling the pressure change and feeling the building sort of vibrate and the glass vibrate. And my mother, bless her, she gets to the front door right as this thing is getting close. And the pressure change was so severe that she had to have some people inside the building come pull on the door while she pushed on it to try and get it open so that she can get inside. And just as she gets inside, this thing hits and all the windows of the library, which was just right inside the front entry, all the windows blew out and they had to take cover there near the front office. Thankfully, nobody was injured in this. And what happened, and I'm sure my mom was praying the whole time, and this is probably why God told her that this was going to happen, is so she could pray against it. But what happened is the tornado, even though it was coming towards the wing of the school where all the kids were, it jumped over that and it hit the cafeteria on the other side. No one was in there because lunch hour had just ended maybe a half hour before. But that cafeteria was absolutely wrecked when that tornado hit it. And later on, when we came back and saw the building later, we saw that the tables had been thrown everywhere inside and outside and twisted up like balloon animals. It was quite the scene. And I'm not sure exactly why my mom had the premonition about this, other than maybe it was so she could pray against it, because she didn't stop it. You know, it's not like her coming to the school was my salvation because she pulled me out of there before it hit and killed everybody. It wasn't that. Everybody was fine. The building was destroyed and we had to go to another school for the rest of the year. But otherwise, it turned out great. My mom didn't remove anyone from danger. So it's kind of a mystery to me. Why did God give her this piece of information ahead of time? I guess to pray. So the third thing that happened when I was a little bit older, I was going away. It was my first time to leave home for a whole weekend to go spend it with somebody else's family. But I was going to my friend Caleb's grandparents' place. They had a farm somewhere in Central Texas, I believe. And it was his birthday weekend, so he was bringing a bunch of kids out there to celebrate with him, which was awesome. It was a lot of fun. I was really psyched up about it. And my mom had this dream ahead of time that I would hurt myself on their go-kart. Now, I think I had told her about the go-kart, but we hadn't really discussed it, and there hadn't been any details given. But she just had a certainty that if I went, I was going to get in this go-kart, and I was going to hurt myself and injure myself somehow on this thing. So she told me, no go-kart if you go. And I argued and argued with that. So she finally said, if you must ride the go-kart, you have to wear a helmet. Like, promise me you're going to wear the helmet. So I hemmed and hawed, but eventually I didn't really have a choice. So I said, okay, I'll wear the helmet. Thankfully, I kept my word, even though none of the other kids wore a helmet. But I watched them go. And when it came to my time, I put the helmet on and I was going to be the driver of the go-kart. And there was a friend of ours who was going to be in the passenger seat the first time around, and then we would switch. Well, there wasn't another time around because I messed up. So I had watched my friend Caleb, who had plenty of experience with this go-kart, drive around the barn and through some other obstacles and then do a loop and come back to where we were. But instead of coming straight up the road the way that he had gone, he decided to take a little detour across this bridge that connected one part of the property to the other over this small creek. So this bridge wasn't much of anything. It was just concrete with no railings at all. and a little bit of a concrete ravine on either side. And it was probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 feet above the creek. And it wasn't very long at all. A very small bridge, but nonetheless, it presented a problem for me because there was loose gravel across this bridge. Well, Caleb had no problem with it because he slowed down before he made the turn. You know, he had it under control. He went across the thing fine and came back around this other way. And I just figured I would take the same route that he took. So I got in after him. I did the same thing, went around the barn. Everything was great. I was feeling good. I gunned it up the road from where the barn was back to where everybody was congregated. And then I did the same thing. I went left over this bridge, but I was going way too fast and he had slowed down beforehand. I had never driven something like this before and I didn't know how slow I needed to be going. So I hit that thing going way too fast, lost control entirely and skidded right off the side of the bridge. And, you know, we didn't have seat belts. So both I and the boy who was sitting in the passenger seat flew out of the go-kart. There was no windshield. It was just a roll bar over the top. And we both went straight out the front of this thing when we hit the wall, the concrete wall on the opposite side of the bridge. So, yeah, we came off to the left. We flew down 2 or 3 feet as we were flying forward into the air and hit this wall, flew out of the go-kart. And for some reason, he didn't hit his head. He must have put his arm out first or twisted in some way. I don't know exactly what happened, but I hit my head. I went crown first into that wall. And the only thing that kept me from probably cracking my skull open was the helmet. And the helmet was cracked itself. So I know it was a really good impact. And luckily, the go-kart, when it hit the wall, bounced backwards and fell straight down on its wheels. It didn't turn over, didn't break it. The go-kart was fine, which was great because when I woke up, my first thought was not about me or the other guy. My first thought was, oh my gosh, I destroyed a go-kart. How much did that cost? So I was paralyzed with the idea that I would have to pay for this thing and have no way of doing it. But thankfully, that was not the case. And then right after thinking that, I thought, ow, because it hurt. And then I looked down at my right arm, I believe it was, my right forearm, and all the skin was gone from that because I had not only hit my helmet, but I had also hit my right forearm and scraped it against the concrete, probably when I fell, not when I hit the wall at first, but on the landing. But the other kid twisted his ankle, had a sprained ankle, and that was it. We were very, very fortunate. It's very possible that I could have died or had some sort of traumatic brain injury if I hadn't worn that helmet. So thanks to my mom for that. And thanks to God for sending that message to my mom, of course. But, you know, those types of things are not coincidences. There's no way my mom could have known that I was going to injure specifically my head. That's something that has to come from a being that knows the future. There's many reasons why I believe in Yahweh and the God of the Bible. But certainly that is one of them because he has saved me. He saved my dad. It's obvious that this being that my parents worship knows the future. And the Bible says that it is only Yahweh who knows the beginning from the end, who knows all things, regardless of where they fall on the timeline. Okay, let's now talk about the prophecies that I've received. The very first prophecy I received was in middle school, and I still don't know if I fully understand why I received this, although within the last year, I have gotten what I believe is the answer to this, but I still need to hear a little bit more from God on this, I think, before I'm ready to really talk about what this meant. But I'll just briefly summarize what happened. I had a dream that I had my head in my locker. I was getting some stuff out, and this friend of mine who was one class ahead of me walked behind me with one of his other friends and pushed my head into the metal inside the locker and then laughed about it and walked away. It was the weirdest dream. It seemed very realistic, but I had never had such a dream before. So I didn't know what to make of it. I just disregarded it. But it was either the next day or the day after at school. Between classes, I actually did have my head in my locker. I was looking for some stuff. And this kid walks behind me and pushes my head forward so that I hit the top of my head on the metal inside the locker. And he cackled about it as he walked away. And I looked, you know, pulled my head out and looked, and he was with somebody else. So at that moment, I knew that I had a premonition of that moment, but I didn't know why. It seemed so entirely random and purposeless. Now, like I said, I think I might know what that was about, but I'm not going to share that right now. Maybe at some future time. So I just totally forgot about it. And it was only years later that I received something else. This was when I was in college. I was an upperclassman, and I had gotten myself totally away from the church and faith, really, in any way. I still believed in God in a very abstract way, but it didn't inform my life. And I was leading a very hedonistic lifestyle at that time. I was pretty rebellious. But I had this dream one night that I was walking in a desert place. Very dark, the sky was overcast, and there was no life, no water. The air was dry. It was just a dry, desolate place. And there's mountains way in the distance, but basically I'm walking on a plain of just cracked mud. And I didn't know where I was going or what I was doing. I just felt very depressed. I felt hopeless. And I was just walking, just one foot in front of the other. And then all of a sudden, the ground opens up beneath me, and I start to fall into darkness. There's nothing down there. It was just black. And as I'm falling, these creatures came up to meet me. And they were inky black too. Like I really couldn't even see their form, although I had some perception of it, I guess. Maybe it was just the way they felt, but I think I perceived their form in some way. But I know that their eyes stood out. Their eyes were yellow and glowing. I remember having the impression that they were very happy to get a hold of me. And this next part is going to be hard to hear, a little bit graphic, perhaps. So if you don't want to hear this, then you might want to skip forward a little bit. But these things had claws, and they just started ripping into me. And they were tearing me apart, and yet I was not coming apart. It was like my form was regenerating or steady or something. I don't know how to describe it other than I was not being dismembered, but I was being torn apart. It's paradoxical, but that's what was happening. And the important thing to tell you about this dream is that it did not seem like a dream. It seemed absolutely real. In fact, it was the most painful and terrifying thing I've ever experienced because it seemed so real. I mean, I felt this happening. And then I woke up after a few seconds, probably, of falling. It's hard to tell exactly how much time had passed, but it wasn't very long after I fell into the ground that I woke up. But I woke up sweating. I mean, profusely sweating. I woke up screaming. I woke up trembling. It was physiologically, it was as if it had happened to me. And it took me a long time to calm down and to finally get back to sleep. In fact, I think I got very little sleep the rest of the night. But that was a bit of a wake-up call for me. Yeah, it really shook me up. And I think it started me down a path of figuring out what was going on spiritually with me. And, you know, was there something spiritual that I needed to learn? And was this a prediction of my future? So I started considering these things. Well, not very long after that, I was in the woods on a camping trip. I was walking out by myself. I had left my friends behind, and I was just on a trail by myself. And while I was out there, I looked up and saw the sun coming down through the leaves of the trees. And in that moment, I saw a little glimpse of the glory of God, and I felt his holiness. And that really gave me the kick that I needed to start exploring the... Really, what I did is I went and absorbed as much information as I possibly could. I just consumed all the things that I could get my hands on regarding religion, because I didn't want to just believe that the God that my parents had taught me about was necessarily the God that I had felt out there in the woods. I wanted to find out what everyone else in the world had to say about this great spirit that I had perceived. And what did they think about him or her, whatever? Of course, I thought it was a him because that's the way I was raised, but I was trying not to make any assumptions about things. So I went and just started devouring religious information. I did a lot of research into the world's wisdom traditions. And at the end of it, I came out knowing that Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Christ, is the Messiah, and he's the way that God has made for us to be reconciled to him. Mostly it's because I got back into the Bible. I got back into the Holy Word at the end of exploring a lot of other stuff. And the text of the Bible was set apart. It was absolutely unlike the other stuff. And it hit me. And especially when I read the Gospels and read the words of Yeshua and read about his life, that hit me. And even though I had heard a lot of this stuff before, it was like I was really experiencing it for the first time. And the Bible just came to life. And I knew this is it, because the words were life. And there was lots of prophecy that had already been fulfilled that testified to the validity of the scriptures. And there were other reasons to believe as well. But all that combined to convince me. And so I gave my life to Yeshua. I promised to be his servant. I asked him to take away my sin. And he did that. I later on got baptized, which, you know, I had been baptized before, but kind of under duress. I hadn't done it of my own volition, so it didn't mean anything. But I got baptized later after coming to belief. So I was saved at that point, and then about a year passed when I was really zealous, man. I was growing in the Lord in leaps and bounds. I was ministering. I was doing really good stuff in my local congregation. I had great fellowship. Life was just good. I mean, I was in the groove and on a great trajectory living this Christian life. And then I had another dream. And in this dream, which was just as realistic as the first one, I mean, more realistic than life, more than waking life, I was standing on a stone bridge overlooking a bay or an inlet of some kind with the sea beyond it and a sunset happening right in front of me. And the colors of the sunset and of the world that I was standing in were unbelievable. They were way better and broader than the colors that we perceive now. They were supernatural colors, I guess I would have to say. It's hard to describe, but there was a spectrum that I was not familiar with in normal life. And the stones of the bridge that I was standing on were like living stones. They seemed to be, they weren't moving, but something about the quality of the stones, they were almost translucent to some extent, and you could see all this color inside of them, and all of it was morphing and moving, shifting as I was looking at it. And they almost seemed to be making sound as well. But I was looking at this sunset and crying because it was so beautiful. And then I heard something even greater than the beauty of the scene. I heard this angelic music, and it was a chorus of all sorts of voices and sounds. And the music was so awesome. It goes far beyond the best music you've ever heard in this life. I mean, think about the finest classical music or the finest opera or something like that. It was beyond that by many times. And as I was listening, I was lifted up. I just started to float up from this bridge, and the music swelled, and I felt like I was going to explode because it was just so overwhelmingly awesome. And then I woke up, and it wasn't very long at all. It was, I don't know, 30 seconds, a minute, maybe. It was a very short dream, but I knew in that moment, coming awake from that and just crying, but not crying because of pain and fright, this time crying because of the awesomeness of it all. I knew that I had transitioned from death to life. I knew that God had brought me out. He had redeemed me from the life, the dead life that I was living before. So those were awesome, and I believe absolutely prophetic of where I was headed. Now, the first dream, obviously, was a conditional prophecy. Okay, the second dream very well could also be a conditional prophecy, because I have a free choice. If I ever wanted to, I could lay down my faith. I could say, I don't believe this anymore. I don't want this anymore. You know, forget it. I don't accept the free gift of salvation anymore. It's not that I can lose my salvation because God will forget about me, or I'm going to sin too much and he's going to, you know, stop giving me forgiveness. The forgiveness is already there in Yeshua HaMashiach. But the fact is, I have free will, so I don't have to take it, just like nobody in the world has to receive salvation. So it's probably conditional, but talk about motivation. Talk about wanting to reach that point. I am absolutely. Now, that being said, you know, that dream didn't always stay with me and motivate me the way that it should have, because later on I backslid and I became a terrible Christian, doing a lot of really selfish things. So even though I had this dream, and it has helped me, it didn't necessarily seal me and keep me from living in a way that God didn't like, because that did happen. But it's always been with me, and it comes back from time to time, and I remember it, and it kind of reinvigorates me to live the kind of life that God wants. And I think that that's one of the reasons I'm at where I am now, is because even though I backslid, I had these things from God that I could grasp and hold on to. And now I'm on that really good path, that narrow path, that if I just stay on it, will lead me to eternal life. And I believe that prophecy will come true.
Hold it right there, Watchman. Get a cup of tea. It's time for Everything Under the Sun, when we take 3 minutes to hear from the Watchman's wife, Amanda Lawrence.
I want to tell you about an old friend and a locked door. This friend of mine is an incredibly strong woman. She's someone that I used to work with. Her past is not mine to tell, but I can say that she suffered and went through things that I had a hard time believing when I first heard them. She was in such a dangerous spot once in her life that she reached out and found an organization that could help her, and they did for 2 years. They helped her heal physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Always a believer, God became even more real to her during her time of restoration. She felt a new direction for her life and took real, tangible steps to implement them. She encouraged me with her resilience and her ability to flourish as a woman of God, despite and maybe because of her circumstances. Now I'll pause here and share a story about that locked door that happened 2 weeks ago. My family was about to go swimming. We had packed the car, kids and all, and I ran back in to get a bottle of water. I came out, the watchman asked for his keys so that he could start the car, and I realized that I had locked the keys in the house and shut the door to the garage tightly behind me. All of us were in the garage with no way back into the house, and it was in the upper 90s. There was one person who has a spare key, but he lived 45 minutes away, so the watchman went to go check the back door in case he left it unlocked after using it that morning. And as he walked around, I started praying, "Yahweh, please let the door be unlocked. We can't pay for a locksmith right now." No dice, locked up tightly. The watchman and I are looking at each other in the garage, him with an expression of amused aggravation and me with an expression that says, "I'm a bad dog," when our son rattles the doorknob and opens the door that leads to the house from the inside. Huh. He chirpily tells us that he had left the front door unlocked last night, so he just went to the front door and got in and was able to let us in. This is an example of an answered prayer. I didn't specify in my prayer which door I wanted unlocked. I prayed with hopeful expectation and faith, and assumed that when God didn't answer my prayer, that he just wanted us to stay outside in the heat to build character or something. But instead, he was making a way in the desert. He took our boy's great mistake and used it for eventual good. So back to the strong woman I mentioned. I hope that this is what God is doing right now. This woman is on a treacherous path again, and I see her disintegrating before my eyes on social media. And due to the nature of our relationship and geographical distance, there's little that I can do for her but pray. I'm praying that this is a smaller valley than the one that she was in when I met her. I'm praying that she removes herself from the people that I see her surrounded with. I'm praying that she stays physically safe and holds on to Jesus right now and remembers that there are people who love her and who can help her. And most of all, I'm praying that this is a season for her that becomes part of her larger story, a part that she can point to and say, "Jesus used me and even this to strengthen me and to inspire others and to be part of his story." I know you have something going on in your life that you don't understand. It might be something small. It might be something big. It is definitely something hard. We need to have the faith that God will use this for our good, that there's something in this that he can take what the enemy has thrown at us and turn it around and redeem it. That's what he does. And I'm so thankful that we serve a God who looks and sees our mess and sees the hard stuff and says, I can use that. So if there is a door in your life that you think is closed and locked tightly, just wait. He'll open an unexpected one.
All right, very good. That was just enough time for me to finish a cup of peach white tea. By the way, my wife does not call me the Watchman when we're just talking to each other or she's talking about me in normal life. I think she's just doing that in her segments because she thinks it's funny. Or maybe she's trying to respect me. I hope that's it. It is funny. But she does not refer to me that way. I just wanted to clear that up. So the next prophecy that I received was about my impending death. This was after I had gone through a long season of backsliding, and I had destroyed my first marriage and a lot of other stuff along the way. And I had finally gotten to a place of responding to conviction again. I was no longer running from the Spirit, but at the same time, I wasn't really running toward Him full force either. What I should have been doing was passionately cleaning my life out, throwing down all of the things that I had set up as idols in my life and just stopping all of the behaviors that I had begun. But I hadn't done that. And so I had this dream, and I don't even remember the dream all that well. I know that in it, my new girlfriend and my ex-wife and some other people who were Christians that I had known were all walking together in a group, and I was walking with them. And then I couldn't go any further, and I stopped for some reason. And they kept going. And I was like, why can't I go with you? Why am I stuck? And they looked back and they said to me, you can't go where we're going. That's the only part of the dream I remember. But I woke up right after they said that. And the way that I felt at that moment was not a normal feeling that I've ever had before. It was like a supernatural certainty descended on me. And I knew without a doubt that I was about to die. And when I say about, I mean in the near future, not like, you know, of course, we're all going to die at some point, and all of our lives are short from a particular perspective. But this feeling was that you have days, weeks, maybe, and then that's it. So it was, you better get your stuff together because you're about to be out of here. I started weeping. I went downstairs and I sat in front of the window. The sun was just coming up. And I started praying to God, and I started to repent, and I told Him, look, I get it, I'm sorry, I respond to this correction, and I will begin to do all the things that you asked me to do. And from that moment on, it has been a good upward trajectory of increasing sanctification. But it was that feeling of certainty, of knowing God was going to take me out, that really built a fire under me. And I wish I was smarter. I wish I could say that I was a wiser person and would have learned some things without having to go through the school of hard knocks, but that's not the case. Anyway, after about 10 to 15 minutes of praying vehemently, I felt that feeling go away. All of a sudden, it was like the doom was not impending anymore. And I knew at that moment that God had said yes, that He was responding to my repentance, and that was changing the future. It was not going to happen the way that I felt prophetically that it was going to happen. I'm still here, so I guess He had mercy. The next prophecy that I received was an indictment of the United States of America. This one's not a real happy one either, but, you know, a lot of times Yahweh's oracles are for our correction. And evidently, He needs to correct this nation that has founded itself upon a lot of Judeo-Christian values. It was not only an indictment of the nation as a whole, but it was also an indictment of the churches within America. Now, this one was not a dream or a vision. It was more like a series of impressions that I turned into a script. So I received this heavy burden to write out this series of indictments. And I sat down and did that in one evening, and there's quite a few of them. I don't usually write that quickly. In fact, I never write that quickly. So the fact that it all came out in a flood in one evening was quite impressive to me, because I felt like God was enabling this. I did not hear God audibly, and he did not put words in front of me that I could write down like a scribe. This was more like heavy emotions and impressions and concepts. They were coming into my mind, and then I was just channeling that onto paper, but it was in my own words. So this was not a thus saith the Lord type of a prophecy. I believe it was from the Lord, but I don't think it was inerrant in the sense that the biblical prophecies are. I turned what I wrote into a video, and if you'd like to see that, you can go to my YouTube channel. It's called Watchman Alexander, but the URL is theapocromancer, youtube.com/user/theapocromancer, because that was the name that I started that YouTube channel with before I started the Watchman Alexander brand. So if you go to that channel and you look at some of the older stuff, you'll be able to find it. It's called The Indictment of America. Now, there's a portion at the beginning of that video, an intro before the indictment start, that I added on. And some of the stuff that's in that intro, I think, is wrong, because I've evolved my understanding of God's calendar and some other things. And, you know, I believed certain things about the Shemitah, not because God had taught me something prophetically about it, just because I thought it sounded good. But I later came to realize that a lot of that stuff was not true. And so there's some things in that intro that, you know, you can disregard now. But everything from indictment number one and on, I believe, is still perfectly valid. Have you heard about that Disney movie called Tomorrowland? Well, I had a vision while I was watching that movie, as strange as that may seem. My wife and I had gone to see it shortly after it came out. And I made a video about this too, so I'm not going to go through it all and explain it all. But basically, I saw a vision superimposed over the screen. And what I witnessed during that probably 30 seconds or so of having a superimposed vision was American cities being attacked with nuclear weapons and also burning. So I saw mushroom clouds, and I saw just widespread fire from who knows what. But this was definitely a vision of America's future, and it did not feel conditional. It felt like this was going to happen, unfortunately. I know that's not great news. I don't like it, but it is what I saw. I was very shaken up. My wife was there with me. She could tell I was very shaken up. And we talked about it for a while after the movie. And the final prophecy that I have to tell you about is a similar thing where I saw an image. This time it really wasn't an image more than just some sort of impression, but I saw a kinetic sculpture over the top of a nurse who was helping me in the hospital. I had come out of surgery and I was laying there recovering, and there were, of course, lots of nurses walking around. But there was one who kept walking by my bed, and every time that I would see her walk by, she had a Newton's cradle, a device called a Newton's cradle, right over her torso, just following her around. So after a couple of times of seeing this, I decided I gotta say something. So I talked to her and I asked her if she was a Christian, because I got this impression that she was. And she said, yes, I am. And I told her, you know, this is going to seem weird, but I'm seeing something over the top of you, and I think it's a prophetic message for you. And so I explained to her what I was seeing. And as I was explaining that it was a Newton's cradle, I didn't remember the term for it at the time, but I was describing what it looked like. And then it came to me and I said, you're going to be buffeted from both sides, but because of your faith in Christ, you're going to remain still and unaffected in the middle. And I think she received it well. In fact, she said she was already feeling a lot of pressure from something. And I wish I knew what happened with her, how that whole scenario turned out. But unfortunately, I have no idea who she was, and I never saw her again. But who knows? Maybe she's listening to this broadcast and she can get a hold of me about it. What I've just told you are true stories. These things actually happened. I'm not making them up. I'm not lying to you. However, I don't think that you should just blindly believe me. I think that you ought to test the spirits. There are many deceptive spirits out there. We're in a war, and the enemy is trying to deceive us, is trying to trick us, trying to get us to do things with our lives that is out of line with truth, so that we cause destruction or we prevent good things from happening. So don't just believe people when they say they've had a prophecy or they've heard something from the Lord. You've got to test it. When you test something, you hold it up against what you know to be true, and that is the Word of God, the revelation that has already come through the Hebrew prophets, that has already been verified by time and by the spirits of many people who have responded to these words. It's been verified by the consistency between the oracles given by different prophets in different time periods. You know, there's a lot of reasons why we believe the Bible, but we do believe it. We know it's the word of truth, and so we have to compare everything to that. Anything new that somebody comes out with that doesn't agree with the already accepted, widely verified scriptures has got to be thrown out. Unfortunately, I'm realizing that I don't have time to get through the rest of the material that I had planned for today. I wanted to talk about the 8 ways that we test the spirits and then talk about some movements of modern day prophets and some false prophecies that we need to be aware of. And I just can't get to any of that stuff. I'm running out of time. So what I'm going to do is break this up into 2 podcasts, and the next one will be dedicated to the discussion of the ways that we test the spirits and also discussion about some of the heretical teachings and prophecies coming out of some of the modern movements. But for right now, let's go to a listener question.
Now it's your turn to direct the conversation. It's listener Q&A.
Kelly Verderaim asks, do you have any insight on Luke 17:36? Was it a mistranslation or something deeper? Wow, Kelly, why didn't you ask me a hard question? This verse is one of the least understood prophetic verses in all of the Protestant Bible. I'm going to take a stab at it. I've actually touched on it a little bit in the 2nd chapter of Leviathan's Ruse, but I'm going to try and expound on that a little bit right now. But this is certainly not something that I can answer conclusively. And I would say if anybody has any great ideas, please get to me with them, because I'm still wrestling with this a bit myself. So that passage in Luke actually starts in verse 26 and goes through 37. I'm going to go ahead and read that for you. Just as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating and drinking and marrying and being given in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But on the day when Lot went out from Sodom, fire and sulfur rained from heaven and destroyed them all. So will it be on the day when the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, let the one who is on the housetop with his goods in the house not come down to take them away. And likewise, let not the one who is in the field turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to preserve his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life will keep it. I tell you, in that night there will be 2 in one bed. One will be taken and the other left. 2 men will be in one field. One will be taken and the other left. There will be 2 women grinding together. One will be taken, the other left. And they said to him, where, Lord? He said to them, where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. So I think the first important thing to realize about this passage is that it is a different version of what we find in the other Gospels, but notably in Matthew chapter 24, the Olivet Discourse. So Luke is a little bit different than Matthew in terms of how he's reporting these events. Luke actually was not there, so he went and got an eyewitness testimony from people who were there at the time that Yeshua was speaking these words. And he compiled these testimonies. He probably condensed it down a bit, and he compiled it in a way that he thought was understandable and readable. It may have gotten a little bit mixed up in terms of the chronology of exactly when certain phrases were used. It doesn't mean that Luke is wrong. It just means he maybe put them together slightly out of order, because in the other Gospels, we see a different order. So let's go over to Matthew and see how he describes this speech, because he probably maintained the narrative flow a little bit better than Luke did. So we're in the book of Matthew, chapter 24, and the first thing to point to is verse 28. because this verse is the same as the last verse that we just read in Luke. But this is only part of the way through the discourse of Matthew. So he's just finished talking about the Son of Man coming in the sky, and everyone sees it. It's like lightning that is seen from the east to the west. And he's also finished warning the disciples not to believe it if someone tells them that the Messiah is in this place or in that place. If he's in the desert or he's in these chambers, don't buy into that, because these people don't know how it is that I'm supposed to come back. He's telling them ahead of time, I'm going to come back in a way that everyone will see it all at once. It'll be really glorious. And you're not going to have any doubt that I have just showed up. When he shows up, we know from other prophetic passages, the armies of the world will gather themselves together, or will have been gathered together, depending on how you want to, you know, explain the chronology there. But they will then go against him in the last battle, the battle at Jehoshaphat and other places. It's kind of a campaign that Yeshua will be on, but it'll end right there outside of Jerusalem. And that's where the armies of the Antichrist will be slaughtered. So that's what happens after he appears. And then we have this verse 28, wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. So I think what this is talking about is he's skipping over some things, but he's saying, when I appear, that's going to kick off this great battle. In fact, throughout the Middle East, he'll be battling the forces of evil. And wherever he leaves these corpses behind, because he's basically going to make a clean sweep through the whole Middle East and even down into Egypt. And wherever he leaves these corpses, it's going to be a feast for the birds. We see that later in Revelation, where an angel is actually calling birds to come and feast on all of the dead soldiers that have been left behind. It's going to be, you know, the greatest gathering of the birds that you've ever seen. That's probably what's being spoken of here. The question is, why does it come earlier in the narrative here in Matthew than it does in Luke? Well, let's keep going and see if we find any other similarities. He talks about after the tribulation, he appears. He speaks about the fig tree, and then he starts to talk about the days of Noah, which is the same thing we saw in Luke. And he says this, "For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man." Verse 38, "For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and one left. Therefore stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming." And then he goes on to explain or give a parable about faithful and wise servants. And then the parable of the 10 virgins. So this all ties in together, but the important thing is we've got the same language here in verses 37 through 42, because, and the question that was asked was about two people being in the field or in the bed or grinding grain together, and one is taken and one is not. You know, what is that about? And I think that's what Kelly is getting at. What's the meaning here? And is there some sort of mystery that we're missing? Because it is difficult to understand why this is placed where it is and how it ties into the rest of these eschatological events. What I would like to suggest is that we look back at the judgment of the time of Noah, because Yeshua is pointing to his time as a comparison for what we're going to be experiencing in the end. Well, in the days of Noah, the flood came for 40 days after Noah and his family had been shut up in the ark for a whole week. That week parallels the week of the Hebrew honeymoon, when the couple shut themselves up in the wedding chamber called the huppah, and for 7 days they are sequestered from the world. Then they emerge and there's a feast. The same thing is going to happen in heaven. The rapture or the resurrection is a pickup for a wedding ceremony. And when we're wed to the Lamb, when the marriage of the Lamb takes place in heaven, after we're resurrected and taken up, we will be in the honeymoon chamber, the huppah, for 7 days. And then after that, there will be a feast. Revelation describes this great wedding feast. We don't know exactly how long that's going to be. I have my theories, but that's the basic order of things. So in the days of Noah, typologically or as a foreshadow, he and his family were shut up for 7 days inside this chamber called the Ark, while the floods of judgment came upon the world. Other prophetic scriptures talk about the day of the Lord as being a day of wrath that is like a flood. And I think that it's meant to link back to the days of Noah. I think there will be 40 days of wrath, and it will be the bowls of wrath that bring this flood of fury and judgment. So the bowls of wrath are what begin the day of the Lord, in my opinion. One of these days in this podcast, I will go over all of the reasons why I think those things, and we'll kind of make a timeline of the end of the age and what we can expect and why, you know, and I'll show you all the verses and how they link together. But for right now, just suffice to say, I think that's what the flood is. And so what happened in Noah's day is that the unbelievers were still in place while he and his family were taken. Some people will look at this this passage in Mark and Luke about the people out in the field, one taken and one left, and they'll say, well, that is about the wheat and the tares. And we see in the parable of Yeshua earlier in his career that the tares are actually taken first. They are bundled up before the wheat is taken. I don't really agree with that. And I'm not going to go into all the reasons why, but I think for right now, I would say the main thing is that that's not what we saw in the days of Noah. And we know there are harvests. There's going to be a harvest of the righteous just about the same time that there's a harvest of the unrighteous. And we see that by looking in the book of Revelation. And there's two angels that are given sickles and they're told to go and harvest the earth. One of the angels brings together the grapes of wrath. One of the angels goes and harvests the good wheat, but they're described as happening right at the same time or pretty much back to back. Now, there could be a gap in there that we don't know about that's not specified in the scripture, but it is telling that the angels do their harvesting both at the same time in the text, and they're both given the command to do that at the same time by the same person. So to me, this is describing the rapture or the resurrection. I think we get confirmation of this in the very next chapter, chapter 25, which starts out with the parable of the 10 virgins. Because how many virgins are taken to the wedding and how many are refused entry? It's one out of every two. It's five wise virgins and five foolish virgins. So what we have here is a 50-50 split in God's flock. There's half of the field or half of the flock is not ready. They're not prepared. They don't have their lamps full of oil. They are not allowed into the marriage. The other half is allowed. Now, I know that this is a very difficult thing for a lot of Christians to grasp, because we've been taught if you're a Christian, you're part of the bride, you're going, you're in for sure. All you have to do is make a confession and you're in, you're the bride. That is not what Yeshua talks about. He talks about his flock being goats and sheep. Goats are rebellious, sheep are not rebellious. Both are in his flock. He talks about the five foolish and the five wise virgins. He talks about tares and wheat in the same field. It's the master's field. He owns it all. And yet there's two different types of grain there. So as difficult as it may be to accept this kind of thing, not everyone is going to get picked up for the wedding. That's why it's so important that we conform our lives to his will, and that in these last days we get pure, because the book of Revelation says he's coming for a pure bride, one that has cleaned herself up and set herself apart, that is holy. So I think what we're seeing here in Luke and Matthew is a description of half of the virgins being taken and the other half are left. Why does Luke then put the thing about the corpses after that? Well, either way, whether we're in Mark or in Matthew, it's not really chronological. The sections within this discourse are chronological, but he goes back and forth a little bit. So the Battle of Armageddon and all of the slaughter of these Antichrist soldiers, that definitely happens after the resurrection. There's no doubt about it. So we're taken away. There's a wedding. Then Jesus comes back with the armies of heaven on horses and sets foot on the earth and goes about his campaign to eradicate the wicked. that's how it's portrayed in the Old Testament prophets. That's how it's portrayed in Revelation. So we know that the wedding takes place before all of that stuff. I think it's about 40 days before, like I said, 40 days of wrath, starting the day of the Lord. So the day of the Lord would be resurrection, and then the bowls of wrath are immediately starting to be poured out. And then 40 days later, after the wedding and the feast and all that has taken place in heaven, then Yeshua is free to return to the earth. Where do I go from here? Okay, so in Matthew, Yeshua talks about these corpses and the vultures right after he describes his coming and how it will be visible. But in Luke, he puts it after the people being taken from the field or from their bed. Either way, chronologically, that's correct within that particular part of the text. So people are taken for the wedding ceremony. Then later, he comes back and there's the great battles of Armageddon. In Matthew, he appears, which insinuates that the wedding has already happened, because he will not appear and come down to the earth until after the resurrection and all of those things are accomplished. Because once he comes and sets down on the earth, as we know from Paul's writings, he stays. That's it. You know, and when he returns and comes to the earth, he's not going back again. He's staying for 1,000 years. And the ones who were resurrected and go to reign with him in Jerusalem are already resurrected. So that means the ceremony has already occurred and they are with him, or else they're waiting for him to conquer the earth and then they go down. So that's the sequence of events that has to happen. Therefore, it doesn't really matter where this verse about the corpses goes in terms of the other stuff that's in the discourse, as long as it's following his appearing or the resurrection in the text. So it does work in Luke's version. It's just that he's not showing as many other parts of the discourse. He's condensing it, and he's just shifting where this verse about the corpses goes in relation to the other subjects being discussed. But still, it's chronologically proper. I hope that made sense. I know that's a little bit complicated, but you picked a complicated passage for me to analyze. So thank you, Kelly. I'm being facetious, of course, but thank you for that. That's actually a really good question.
If you'd like to have Watchman Alexander answer your question in a future episode, please send an email to questions@watchmanalexander.com with your city and state or region in the subject line.
If you would like to send in a question, I ask that you record it, make an audio recording, and attach that file to your email, because I would like to broadcast your voice asking the question. I think it's more interesting that way. So please make sure that you record it, save the file, and then attach it to your email when you send it to me. And as we wrap up here, I want to let you know that if you would like to have me come to your congregation or your organization and speak about the Antichrist, the end times, personal moral excellence, how we can get prepared, any of those topics, I am available to speak on those things, and I can even do a full day seminar if you would like to have a more extensive class. So please check out the speaking page on my website. That is watchmanalexander.com/speaking.html. watchmanalexander.com/speaking.html. That's all for today. Thanks so much for joining me. And until next time, be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. Watchmen out.